This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Fed Access with Derek T. Dortch on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Derek walks you through how to win government jobs and contracts, effectively manage your government career, and best utilize government services. Every week on Fed Access, you'll learn about interesting federal agencies, workers, and jobs. Fed Access provides you the access you need to succeed in the federal government. And now your host, Derek T. Dortch.
Welcome to Fed Access with Derek T. Dortch on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Thank you for stopping by the show. Today, we're going to be talking about three different issues. You know, we always at Fed Access like to kind of focus in on the world and find out what's going on in terms of international security issues, international affairs, national security issues that, you know, not only impact us in terms of our military and national security apparatus, but they have an impact on us all, because everything that's global at some point in time always has an impact on us locally. So we like to stay abreast of things and keep on finding out what's going on. We've got one of our favorite guests, Fred Burton. He's a vice president of intelligence from Stratfor. And you can find Stratfor, their private intelligence firm that deals with global issues. Every single thing you can think about, from terrorism to the counter-narcotics or narco-trafficking, human trafficking, to just global issues as it relates to economics and everything else. You can find them at Stratfor.com, but they're a great place to find out what is going on in terms of crisis and any other issues that's international. Fred, welcome back, and Happy New Year.
Thank you for having me.
Hey, thanks for being back on. You know, a lot of things are happening right now, Fred. We've got a couple of different things I want to talk about. We've got the Olympics that's coming up in Russia. You know, people are excited about it. Winter Olympics, Russia really advocated to get that thing there. They put a lot of money into building up, you know, Sochi and every other place. But there's been some chaos and some terrorism incidents and seeming to try to really cause some chaos and dismay in Russia. We've had some suicide bombings. We've had some shootings in that area. There are some warnings that are going out to Westerners about being very, very careful. If you go into Russia and go into the Olympics, that and Russia talking about putting a security lockdown in that area. What's going on in that region?
Well, certainly the Russians are going to have their hands full with Sochi. And if you look at every Olympics gets much more complicated. The security apparatus that it takes to secure the various Olympic venues becomes challenging. It's just the transportation infrastructure of moving people to and from. And of course, the rules have changed. If you go back even to Munich in 72, and every Olympics, they get more complex and more sophisticated with the personnel involved. But on the operational front, Derek, remember, you've got a tremendous amount of U.S. government help to the Russians, most importantly, in the form of the State Department's Diplomatic Security Service, my old organization, as well as the FBI, that's providing some special event management assistance. And so the eyes of the world may be fixated on Sochi, but on a positive note, the intelligence eyes of the world from all the different nation states that are participating, that are fixated on the protection of their own athletes, are also looking for intelligence and chatter and any kind of threat that you can imagine. And the system actually works at these international events. Information is passed, it's triaged, and although from a foreign counterintelligence perspective, Russia may still be the U.S.'s enemy, when it comes to the protection of life and property at one of these international events, I'm confident that the system's going to work and work very well.
You know, when we look at the situation over there and all the different, like you mentioned, DSS, Diplomatic Security Service, FBI, CIA, and everybody working with the Russian intelligence and security services, you know, who is this threat over there? Who is this a unified threat that is you know, doing the suicide bombings? And what are they after? Is there something that they're trying to get at specifically when they're doing this? I mean, of course, this is for them, they feel like it's a great venue because all eyes are on Russia for the Olympics. But what are they trying to get at?
Well, this is in the North Caucasus there. These are breakaway insurgent groups that are hell-bent on embarrassing Russia, taking advantage of the opportunity with the eyes of the world looking at Sochi. Much like Black September did in 1972 in Munich to elevate Palestinian awareness was the motive behind the 72 Olympic takeover and the killing of the Israeli athletes. So the insurgents in Russia know that this is a wonderful opportunity with the media surrounding the Olympics that anything that happens or occurs will resonate immediately all around the world, and rightfully so. Now, the probability of something happening from a terrorism perspective inside the Olympic Village or any of the Olympic venues are remote. You know, the Russians are going to have a good concentric ring of security plan in place. The challenge is the infrastructure coming in, the transportation, the trains, the buses, the soft target hotels on the various perimeters. Much like what happened to us in Atlanta, we had protection of all the athletes in Atlanta. Everything was fine until the bomb went off in Centennial Park right outside of the security perimeter that we had established. And so in context, it's going to be impossible for the Russians to protect every potential venue outside of Sochi. And to be frank, if an explosion takes off in Moscow during the Olympics, that's also going to cause disruption to the Olympic Games as well. So it's the nature of the beast today in hosting one of these international events.
You know, do you think that what's happening, do you think it's going to dissuade some people from now going? I know that is, you know, you guys are monitoring it, and you may even be hearing from some of your clients, your corporate clients and everything else, who may be sending or thinking about sending executives. Are you hearing people who are now kind of questioning whether they should go and you know, to this Olympics because of the situation, or when people are hearing about the confidence of a security blanket being put in this area, are people still feeling pretty confident about this?
Your large international sponsors are going to be and have been for quite some time working hand in glove with the Russians and the International Olympic Committee and so forth. They've got a vested interest as well, and you raise a very good question, Derek, because most people behind the scenes fail to recognize the power of the corporate sponsors for one of these Olympic events. And so there's a tremendous amount of pressure on the business community to make sure everything goes off without a hitch. And for the most part, it will. But what happens behind the scenes is the executive protection groups, the folks that's protecting the CEOs and their executives for their special tents and their special venue meetings and parties and so forth, there's an element of angst there, primarily dealing with logistics, meaning, mm-hmm. God forbid something happens, how are we going to get our people in and out? If the Russians clamp down and my CEO wants to leave to go back to Washington or New York tomorrow, how do I get him out of there quickly? Right. So most of that kind of concern comes in the contingency planning of, well, let's make sure we've got secondary kind of routes to get out. If we can't fly a helicopter, can we take a car? So you get these kinds of discussions behind the scenes of how am I going to get my primary people out of this venue if something should occur.
You know, with all of that, and as you mentioned, you know, because it's going to be saturated. There's going to be a lot of high-level people there. And so, therefore, they're not going to be able to get helicopters or planes. And if it is a lockdown, like you mentioned, it's going to be a complete lockdown where no one wants to, you know, no one's going to leave and everything else. You know, with this, the dynamics of looking at business and terrorism, you know, are we looking at a new cycle in terms of terrorists now saying that, and they've always hit big events, you know, like you mentioned, the Munich Olympics and everything else. Is this going to be a continuous trend of certain terrorist organizations, not just, you know, with this group here, but are they going to look at this and say, you know, is an Al-Qaeda or Al-Shabaab or others going to, you know, maybe continue to use this kind of roadmap of using these kind of popular events to really highlight, you know, their organization and highlight their cause?
I think historically, if you look at the evolutionary cycle of some of these groups, they certainly would very much like to, like, carry out some sort of attack during an inauguration or a Middle East peace conference or an Olympics in Sochi. Then it gears back down to, it's very, very difficult to pull off a very complex kind of terrorist attack during such a heightened security window.
Mm-hmm.
So then that kind of pushes the threat onto the perimeter and really pushes the threat into the public safety apparatus. You think about the Boston Marathon. The Boston Police Department did all they could do in many ways to secure those routes. They didn't have the intelligence they needed to find the bombers and the brothers. Which is, curiously, you've got the Russian nexus there, too. So those are the kinds of events that would be hard-pressed to be carried off in a practical manner in Sochi during the Olympics. But as you push out from the perimeters, those are the kinds of things that I would be worried about, a bomb going off on a train coming in.
Right.
That kind of event.
Because the security, I mean, you've put so much manpower and so many resources into, you know, guarding a centralized area. As you mentioned, a lot of resources will be depleted, like you mentioned, extended out to a train or hotels or other areas, which are still going to be crowded, very much so. But they may not have that same level of high security of military or police or very well-trained security guards in those areas.
Without a doubt. I mean, think in concept of the D.C. subway. It's extraordinarily difficult, if not impossible, to screen the volume of passengers on any given day. NYPD has tried to do that from time to time with some of their bag checks and so forth. But if you get closer and closer to the venues, you can restrict down bags and packages, and you can do help with technology and metal detectors and handheld wands. At the end of the day, though, you're still dealing with, you need the intelligence ahead of time of what these groups are planning to do.
Right. We got to take a quick break, Fred. When we come back, I want to keep on talking about a little bit more about this. For anybody who's going to be going to Sochi, I just want maybe a couple tips to say, hey, listen, how can you make sure, and of course, you can't prevent everything, but how can you make sure you keep yourself as safe as possible in that environment? You've dealt with that many times working for Diplomatic Security Service, and now with the work you're doing with Stratfor, we want to get a couple tips from you. But then we want to go into Benghazi. You wrote a book called Under Fire, right? Is that right, Fred?
Correct. It's called Under Fire, The Untold Story of the Attack in Benghazi.
You wrote this book about Benghazi. We just had the Senate report that came out, and we want to talk about that on Fed Access and get your take on it and go from there. We're talking to Fred Burton. He's the Vice President of Intelligence from Stratfor. You can find him at Stratfor.com. They are a geopolitical intelligence firm, a private firm that focuses in on all these critical issues that are going on in the world. We'll be right back after this break. You're listening to Fed Access with Derek T. Dorch on Federal News Radio at 1500 AM. Welcome back to Fed Access with Derek T. Dorch on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. If you're just joining us, we've been talking about some of the international issues that are going on right now. We're talking about the Olympics and the security situation of the Olympics that is going to be happening in Russia in February. And now we're going to be talking about Benghazi in a few minutes. And then we're going to be talking about what's going on in Mexico, an issue that always kind of gets pushed under the table, but there's a lot going on. And we have one of the experts who knows what's going on in these issues. issues. We have Fred Burton with us. He's a vice president of intelligence for Stratfor. You can find them at stratfor.com, but they're a geopolitical intelligence firm that covers all of these international security issues, any kind of crisis issues, any international affairs issues going on around the world. Fred, we were talking about Sochi and the security situation, definitely a clamp down by the Russians, but for a person who's going to be attending, maybe somebody who's listening or somebody who knows somebody who's going to be attending, you know, what should they do in terms of personal security in an international environment where there is this possible threat of terrorism that is very, very real? And then, of course, there's always a threat of pickpocketers and other personal security issues. But a couple of tips for somebody who is going into that environment.
Well, the first thing I would recommend would be maintain a high degree of situational awareness. Make sure that you're alert and you're cognizant of any suspicious bags that might be left in areas where there shouldn't be and unattended, and make sure you bring that to the attention of someone. But more importantly, move away from that as quickly as possible. When in doubt, just move away from the problem. We call that getting off the X. The second part, which I would encourage your listeners to consider, would be to travel with a smoke hood. This is a device that you can place over your head that provides you a little bit of good air, gives you time to either vacate a hotel that perhaps is under fire or some sort of chemical has been dispersed, or tear gas, or on any of the public transportation where something could occur. I know a lot of folks that travel with these now. I have one that I travel with in my office that I'm looking at, and that's the one personal safety thing that really cropped up out of a lot of different venues, and most notably Benghazi, too, where smoke hoods could have certainly played a part. But this is a real lifesaver.
And you know, Fred, let me interject on that, because I'm thinking about, you know, when the Taj Mahal and the attacks in Mumbai, a hotel attacks. And like you mentioned, Benghazi, where there's going to always be an explosion, there's going to always be a fire, subway attacks in Spain. I mean, this like you said, this could have possibly prevented some deaths.
Without a doubt. These things do save lives, but it's like all things in emergency preparation. Unless you've thought about it ahead of time and you don't have one, it's too late.
Right.
And I know people that religiously travel with these. They're aboard all the aircraft that protect cabinet-level officials. They travel with protection agents. These are devices that are relatively inexpensive in the grander scheme of events when you start looking at technology, but it's also something that at least you can proactively be thinking about and do to take care of yourself or your loved ones in one of these kind of events, if, God forbid, you're ever saddled with trying to deal with this. But a lot of people get caught up when I see this in international trips and in demonstrations and violent demonstrations. So this is also something that can help you with any kind of police tear gas or dispersal agent that's being used. And then from your general life safety issue, if you're on a train or a bus that's been bombed, you can stick this on your head and hopefully it gives you enough time to get out of the venue and lead your way to safety.
You know, when we think about these things, and a lot of people aren't going to have bodyguards or executive protection, is there any advice in terms of, I know a lot of people probably already have their hotels, you really can't avoid crowds, but, you know, should a person avoid either a major crowd situation or just avoid certain things in order to kind of say, you know what, you're more likely to be in a situation where something could go off if you're in here, this environment?
And that's a very good point, but it's extraordinarily difficult to do, having worked on Olympic venues, that these are always crowded. There's a tremendous number of media and tourists and corporate sponsors, and it's very difficult to go anywhere in an Olympic event and not face crowds. But you can still be alert to your surroundings. You can still kind of linger off to the side and not be paranoid on these kinds of events, but just to maintain a good degree of alertness and know that if something doesn't look right, it probably isn't. And then just think about, from a psychological perspective, what are you going to do if something does happen? If you're sitting at the opening ceremonies and you're buried in the midst of the crowd, Where are you going to go if something happens? Do you have a plan ahead of time?
Right.
90% of most people don't.
And that's the thing. Should people, you know, if before you travel and everything else, and kind of, I know that there probably may be limited information about some of the venues because some of these things are just being built and being finished right now. But should people really spend a lot of time and kind of, like you just said, kind of map out, hey, I'm going to be at this venue. These are the streets. I'm going to, you know, do some Google Maps or whatever the case is. I'm going to map out the streets. I'm going to map out, you know, maybe Alpha, Bravo, and Charlie route to my back to my hotel. Or, you know, we're going to have a rally point for me and my family. Should these things kind of, you know, should a person spend that kind of meticulous detail in terms of planning out their security plan?
The old area of familiarization, without a doubt. I think that's always prudent to do, depending upon the size of the family that is traveling, because there's one given fact based on all the different attacks we've had, whether it be Boston, New York, or Mumbai. The first thing that's going to go down is cell phones,
mm-hmm.
meaning you're not going to be able to get a hold of your loved one to see where they're at. You're not going to be able to call home. So it's important to say, look, if something should happen, we're going to meet at this location,
mm-hmm.
And have a location where everybody knows that this is where people are going to gather. But again, Derek, to your point, very few people think about that ahead of time and will go to the trouble of laying it out.
Right.
I would strongly encourage them to, at minimum, even if they don't want to spend the money to buy a smoke hood, to think about that. The phones go out, where are we going to meet? It can be something simple.
That's right. You know, Fred, these are all good tips. Let me kind of pivot us to Benghazi, because this report came out recently and really kind of touched on, and I know you, me and you had talked about this before, and you've been talking about it in other outlets. With this report and your book, and because a lot of the stuff that's in the report is in your book that came out before the report, what did this report say about Benghazi? Because, you know, they're saying that this thing could have been prevented. You know, what in your book Under Fire about the untold story about Benghazi and this report, what is being said?
Well, the interesting thing with this is it does publicly fill in some missing gaps of and clarifies from a factual chain of what took place, and also comes out with some pretty strongly worded suggestions on what principally the State Department should have done leading up to this event. And of course, we did talk about a lot of things that were disclosed this week in the Senate report in our book. But at the end of the day, as you look at the State Department, this is an organization that has a tremendous amount of tragedy and disaster in the past. I was hired as an agent as a result of the Beirut embassy bombings. But it just wasn't Beirut. It was Beirut 1, Beirut 2, the U.S. Embassy Kuwait, all the hijackings. I mean, there's a long history of diplomats being killed, assassinated, kidnapped, and falling in harm's way around the globe. It's a dangerous world. And as you look at a place like Benghazi, this was a dangerous outpost. Very similar to a lot of other dangerous outposts we had on 9/11, you know, places like Kabul or Baghdad or Khartoum. So it becomes one of risk mitigation, meaning if you only have a number of fixed assets, only so many special agents that you have that you can dispatch around the world, where are you going to deploy them on any given basis? And so the job is really compounded with a very internal dysfunctional system inside the State Department before Benghazi, with the organization buried in this flowchart that reports up to the management cone of state, and management wants that because they control the budget. The Diplomatic Security Service has the largest budget inside the State Department, so as you and I know from your days in the government, whoever controls the money controls the resources.
That's right.
And so you've got a very bureaucratic and some would say systemic failure process inside the State Department as a result of this.
You know, as we think about this, and we got to take a quick break, but I want to come back to this. And I know there was recommendations made, and I know you have, you know, seen the things firsthand when your time in State Department in the Diplomatic Security Service. You know, I want to kind of talk about what can change this. I mean, if people talk about this can be prevented, and you know, because, you know, security always takes a back seat until something happens, you know, and I want to kind of see if hopefully maybe this report and your book and other things like that can maybe put it in a front seat perspective. I mean, you know, who knows? I mean, like you said, it's all politics and it's all about money. But I want to talk about what recommendations do you think can maybe prevent something else from happening again at a State Department or U.S. facility. We're talking to Fred Burton. He's Vice President of Intelligence at STRATFOR, and he also used to work for State Department in the Diplomatic Security Service. He was Deputy Director of Counterterrorism there. He has a new book out called Under Fire. It's Under Fire, The Untold Story of Benghazi. Is that right, Fred?
That's correct.
It's Under Fire, The Untold Story of Benghazi. He has that book out right now that talks about much of the stuff and much more that came out of the report that the Senate just released about Benghazi. We're about to take a quick break. We're going to keep on talking about these issues when we come back. You listen to Fed Access with Derek T. Deutsch on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Welcome back to Fed Access with Derek T. Deutsch on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. If you're just joining us, we are talking about Olympic security. We're talking about Benghazi. And in the last segment of the show, we'll be talking about Mexico and what's going on with there. All international issues that America's involved in some form or fashion. There is no area around the world that does not impact us in America. And that's why we're staying abreast of these issues. We're talking to Fred Burton. He's Vice President of Intelligence at STRATFOR. You can find him at stratfor.com. They're a geopolitical intelligence firm that supports government, private sector, NGOs, and provides them good intelligence and analysis on all these critical issues, on certain events, security, terrorism, economic issues, and everything else. But you can also get your subscription for yourself if you want to, and you can look on their site, stratfor.com, and keep abreast of the issues. Fred, we were talking about Benghazi, and you know, and you wrote your book, Under Fire, The Untold Story of Benghazi, and you kind of pointed out a lot of these different things that came out of the report. You know, some of it seemed to be some systematic failures. Some of it seemed to be maybe, like you said, just a lack of preparation. That was a kind of a area that wasn't a hardened. I mean, not every part where Stevens was not hardened. What recommendations came out of your book and out of this report that you think can be implemented that would save lives next time?
Well, first, Eric, I think the State Department has very aggressively tried to get in front of this post-Benghazi. It's not unusual for government to be in a reactive mode versus a proactive mode. The State Department is no different than the FBI or the CIA or DOD on those kinds of issues, let's face it. Now, as a result of Benghazi, they have created an assistant secretary position for high-threat posts, which is a very positive move. They got a very good man in that position to oversee all these high-threat locations like Benghazi, making sure that our physical security standards are up to par as best they possibly can be. But the nature of the business and expeditionary diplomacy is that the Foreign Service is out in these areas that are challenging to kind of protect. So how do you protect these facilities when fire is used as a weapon? Which is what happened in Benghazi. Very simple things like smoke hoods would have helped significantly in Benghazi. Better intelligence to indicate that things were starting to unfold at a granular level there. The simple fix for that is to have some counter-surveillance assets on the perimeter, special agents out outside of the embassy walls looking for hostile surveillance as part of the terrorist attack cycle. I know for a fact that tactical medical training that the agents had received saved lives.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's some basic simplicity kind of things that have come into play here that needs to get bigger and more robust, such as ensuring that everybody has good tactical medical skills. So if a Foreign Service officer is injured or shot at, that you know what to do quickly. I think if you look at this, what most people don't understand due to the politics of Benghazi if you look over the history of the State Department Security Department, which goes back to 1916, you have a long list of attacks, and some would argue that it's just the nature of the business, and as the world has gotten much more complex, you're going to have personnel in certain locations, and it boils down to, at the end of the day, the resource commitment to make sure you got enough assets on the ground to protect the personnel so they can do their job.
You know, looking at the report, and I'm even looking at it right now as you're speaking, you know, and you mentioned about this, these new positions, you know, the Deputy Assistant Secretary for High Threat Posts and other kind of positions. And the report talks about kind of ensuring that threats are quickly assessed and security upgrades are put in place without minimal bureaucratic delay. You know, we always hear these things. And I think you have both been around long enough to hear, you know, what is good rhetoric. And then what is truly being put in place that's going to be real. Do you think that kind of doing these things and kind of upgrading the levels of DSS people and putting these new positions in play, is that going to give the juice to get the money and the resources to make, you know, to make things happen very, very quickly? I mean, you know, given your experience in DSS and looking at state, I know things change, but do you think that will give the juice to do it?
I think that we're much better today than we were when Benghazi happened inside the Diplomatic Security Service. Mm-hmm. But, Derek, at the end of the day, you still have an organization that's a subset relegated under the management chain. And until the agents have a seat at the table, mm-hmm. reporting directly to the Secretary of State, mm-hmm. Without having to jump through the management level, the assistant secretary levels, and on up and up and up, I think you're always going to have systemic failure. I don't think Congress went far enough with mandating certain changes that could have been done. The Foreign Service will fight you tooth and nail on that because they're going to tell you that they're better put in a position to manage this. And I can't tell you in the past how many Foreign Service officers believe that they're security experts. Mm. And they're not.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so you have the politics of that inside the department, where your promotions and your career is geared towards how you interact with these other management kind of cone personnel and that really have their thumb on the organization. So I'm not overall optimistic that anything is going to be strategically fixed. I think on a tactical perspective, things have been fixed. But until they break themselves out of the management chain, you're going to continue, I'm afraid, to see disasters down the road.
And you know, kind of speaking from experience, right? When a DS agent is at an embassy or an outpost, they're answering to that ambassador, right? That's who they're directly answering to. Even though they're in charge of security, can sometimes an ambassador override a security decision?
Absolutely. One thing that nobody talked about logically in any of the hearings, Derek, was as the president's representative to Libya, as the chief of mission, the United States ambassador is responsible for the protection and welfare of all official personnel in country, to include himself.
Mm-hmm.
So at the end of the day, it is the buck does stop at the ambassador's desk. Now, if you have a good ambassador that understands the risk and the realities of things, things work well.
Right.
If you have an ambassador that thinks security is a burden and really doesn't want to listen, doesn't like to wear his or her badge inside the embassy, wants to go to areas that they shouldn't, then your life is miserable.
Right.
So that's the practical aspects of the job where you see a lot of turnover because of that. There's mm-hmm. a lot of morale issues. And so people bid on assignments based on the kind of job they're going to do, hoping that they're allowed to do their job once they're in these locations.
You know, with all of that, is there a override? And I don't know if this needs to be congressionally mandated or anything like that, but if a DS agent on the ground sees that an ambassador is constantly putting themselves in a high-risk situation or things like, and I know this becomes very, very political, so sometimes there's an apprehension to report that up, but is there a way that the DS agent can say, listen, this ambassador is completely overriding security protocol and I cannot completely ensure their safety if they do this? Is there a way to get that up the chain and then to come back down from the Secretary of State, like, listen, you're going to have to listen to your security detail? Does that work?
It works on paper, theoretically, but it doesn't work practically, meaning
okay.
The person that drops that dime back to Washington is usually identified as the problem,
mm-hmm.
and very quickly is moved on to another assignment.
Wow.
Because it's not viewed in the hallways of Foggy Bottom as in the spirit of cooperation.
Right.
This person cannot get along. It must not be the embassy or the post. It's got to be him or her. And in some cases, no doubt there probably has been, but they do have the ability to go to their management team in Washington. They have the ability to send in a message that is answered by reportedly independent parties. They can go to the inspector general route, but they've had their issues there at state, which have been very well documented as well. So it really boils down to, it can be a fairly miserable kind of experience. So most people just say, I'm going to buy my time and get out of here as quickly as I possibly can and move on. You can only disrupt that kind of boat inside the system for so long before you're viewed as that kind of agent that can't get along.
And then basically it's a career killer for you, for the most part. You won't be promoted, or you won't get good assignments, or you'll be put into some kind of outpost by yourself somewhere.
Yeah, your career pretty much is over once you decide to color outside the lines on those kinds of issues. You're protected for a while with whistleblower kind of protection if you've gone to the Hill or whatever, but at the end of the day, it still places you in a very problematic career kind of place that none of us would ever want to be in. Especially me, again.
Yeah, I just, you know, it's so unfortunate that when you're trying to do your job sometime and try to keep people safe, that the politics get in the way. We got to take a quick break, Fred. When we go into the last segment, we're going to talk about Mexico, important issues on our borders that are always going on. That's always want to bring you on, Fred, because you always remind us of what is going on in Mexico and why we need to stay abreast of this issue. We're talking to Fred Burton. He's a vice president of intelligence at Stratfor. You can find him at stratfor.com, geopolitical intelligence firm that is covering all international security issues. They got some great stuff on their website. So much stuff to cover. I wish we could cover all of it, but we're going to hit Mexico when we come back. Listen to Fed Access with Derek T. Dorch on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Welcome back to Fed Access with Derek T. Dorch on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. If you're just joining us, we've been talking about three specific issues: the Olympics, then the security in the Olympics that's coming up in Russia. We've been talking about Benghazi and what happened with this Senate intelligence report, and our guest, Fred Burton, Vice President of Intelligence at Stratfor, and about his book that reported on Benghazi, Under Fire, the untold story of Benghazi. And now we're going to be talking about Mexico and what's happening down there with the cartels, the drug business, and everything else. Our guest is Fred Burton, again, Vice President of Intelligence at Stratfor, which is a geopolitical intelligence firm that covers all of these issues. Fred, what's happening on our borders right now?
Well, Mexico is a country that we follow very, very closely here at Stratfor and have been reporting on the scope of cartel violence, the cartel war, for quite some time. As you look at Mexico, we don't see the violence decreasing. We see the violence staying about the same as we push into 2014. There are ebbs and flows of geography that, depending upon the group that controls the areas, that have moved a little bit. But that's been a natural progression here. As you get closer and closer to the border, to the very lucrative plazas, the points of entries into the United States, those are critical transshipment points for drug trafficking organizations. Therefore, when you see stability, you don't see violence at the plazas, Juarez, El Paso, Laredo, Nuevo Laredo, for example, then you've got cartel control. But the shortage of, there's no shortage of drugs still being decreased, flowing north, predominantly over land routes into the United States, and then weapons and stolen cars and bulk cash flowing south. The cartels are doing a little bit of tactical shift. They're using what is called a shotgun approach. For example, instead of pushing one big load in a tractor trailer through a plaza, they'll do 10 smaller loads all across the border, recognizing that there's going to be some natural shrinkage, meaning 2-3 might get picked off by sheer luck, but 7 is going to get across.
You know, with all of that, and as you mentioned, the violence is not going down. You know, they're changing some of their methodologies and everything else. I've even read that some of the cartels are consolidating, you know, in terms of what they're doing. Is this increasing their power, this consolidation move, or what's going on with that?
As you look at some of the Mexican government's efforts to go after certain groups, predominantly like the Zeta organization, one of the more violent groups, their demise has been reported by many others for quite some time, but they've still survived. What the organization has done has been brilliant from a marketing as well as a business perspective. They started to put some of their direct representatives into cities so they can further take over the retail distribution network, and therefore they don't have to give a share of that cut to that local criminal gang. And so how this is important to your listeners, as I try to explain to others as I go around the country, is this. You can look at your homicide rate in the city of the district, and you know better than I how many have occurred, and you can look and see that the bulk are being carried out due to drug-related crime.
Right.
That is a direct relationship between the Mexican cartels in Mexico and part of that retail distribution process that they have in those certain areas. And so you're seeing more and more of direct Mexican representation as part of that drug trafficking organization in cities like Houston, Dallas, Austin, Los Angeles, Chicago, Atlanta, where you have local distribution reps for that organization that's responsible for getting the product to the street, collecting the money, and getting it back to south of the border.
You know, this distribution, and you know, you see the game change in terms of legalization, you know, Colorado and other places legalizing marijuana and other things like that. I know me and you have talked about, you know, how do we stop this drug game? You know, how do we, do you think that this shifting in terms of the politics of legalization of drugs and everything else is going to be something that will maybe hurt the cartels or be a game changer, or it's not, it's just a bump in the road, or it doesn't have any kind of impact?
If you look at the drug trafficking organizations, Derek, this is another concept that most people don't understand. This is a criminal enterprise that's involved in everything from child prostitution, human trafficking, home invasions, burglaries, breaking into cars, stolen parts. You have Al Capone-esque organizations that, when they're not running dope to the streets, they're coordinating home invasions. Mm-hmm. When they're not coordinating home invasions, they're stealing weapons and pushing them back down south. So as you look at some of these areas, and I don't think the data sets I've seen any recent ones, but the question I would ask is be careful what you wish for in some of these areas, because I would venture to guess you're going to see an uptick in other related kinds of crime. So if this gang in Colorado can't sell weed on the streets of Denver, they're going to be looking to break into more homes or steal property from cars or steal cars or carry out more armed robberies. So they'll just adjust depending upon the shifts that law enforcement have made.
You know, you bring up an excellent point, Fred, and I wish we could even talk about this more, but people don't realize how much this is coordinated. A lot of people think home invasions are some kind of random act that happens, or that some of these crimes across different parts of the country are random, where, you know, in many cases, not every single case, but in many cases, like you mentioned, it's a coordinated effort by a bigger organization.
That's right. We had a very sophisticated assassination of a cartel-related lawyer in a high-end, upscale neighborhood of Dallas. Very equivalent to something happening in Chevy Chase or McLean, mm-hmm. where these things just don't happen. And this is a long way from the border, where they brought in a hit team. They had multiple cars. They had multiple suspects. They had surveilled this lawyer for quite some time, kill him in broad daylight, and flee back across the border.
Hmm.
That's their tactical capability. And, of course, we had, meaning we, the United States government, and all of our efforts had no clue this was unfolding until after the fact.
Right.
And so they have that kind of tactical capability. They can reach out and touch whoever they want in the United States, but they've been very judicious on to who they kill. They know the value of marketing and PR. They know that they can't kill too many people that might bring undue press attention to them, but as long as they kill other drug dealers or rivals, nobody's really going to give a darn.
Right, right, right. People look at it as just, you know, you took somebody bad off the street, so no one's going to really pay attention to it, yeah.
That's right. Or you're going to get the citizen reaction of, well, we live in some of these areas that, you know, are drug infested, and this is just the way it's been, and it's the way it's always going to be. And so if there's another murder today, well, that's just the way it's always been. But as you look at that root cause of that murder, you're going to see that you probably have a turf issue involving the Mexican retail distribution network as it pertains to that street corner in Washington, D.C.
Right. I wish we could talk about this more, Fred. We got to conclude it here, but I'm definitely going to have you back, because these issues are, like you mentioned, these issues are really not only at our back door, but it's at our front door, and we got to pay more attention to it in order to try to figure out a solution to it. Thank you so much for providing the insight on Saatchi, on Olympics, on looking at Benghazi and looking at Mexico and the issues there, Fred. Thank you for so much.
My pleasure. Anytime, Derek.
You've been listening to Fed Access with Derek T. Dortch on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. Fed Access with Derek T. Dortch, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.